Welcome to this week's edition of World Crisis Radio. This is Webster Tarpley speaking from Washington, D.C. It's the afternoon of November 6th, 2015. Apologies for missing a program last week. I was in a place in rural Hessen that just didn't have a internet signal strong enough to do Skype, and other methods proved prohibitive. So welcome back. Here we are this week. Everything hunky-dory all around, we hope. So we're coming out of two conferences here, two very important ones. The Rome Conference of October 26th. That's an international conference with 9 or 10 countries about taking down the central apparatus of NATO, breaking up the NATO alliance, right, going to a neutral Europe. And of course, this corresponds to the disgust and horror felt in Europe about the activities of the neocons, the CIA, the humanitarian bombers, and so forth. And then the other very interesting conference, this one larger, but rather more sort of focusing on Germany. This was in Friedberg, north of Frankfurt am Main, and that was on the 31st of October and November 1st. So I urge you, take a look at those conferences, my speeches, one of them in Italian and English, and the other one, I fear, only in German. Those are available. Now, there would be much to say about this European situation, but let's get to the part of it that we think we can impact. In my speech at Friedberg, I focused on this question of the Syrian civil war and how to stop the Syrian civil war. And this, of course, is of vital importance for Germany and the rest of Europe, because we've got a situation where there is this huge tide of refugees. The figures I have in front of me are that so far this year, 750,000 refugees from the Middle East have poured into Europe. That's already three times the amount of 2014, so three times as much. And a large contingent, 200,000, came in October. Any idea that the flow of refugees was going to slow down because of the winter months and because of the increasingly rough seas in the Mediterranean, that turns out just not to be true. And there may be 500,000 or 1 million refugees on the roads and on the waterways at this time. So the problem is, it is in no way, a denigration or a rejection of these refugees to say that this level of influx of refugees simply overwhelms the rather rudimentary structures that have been made available, and that it's too much. It's overwhelming the capacity of these countries, and it's causing a lot of problems. Now, there's a whole dimension of problems that has to do with racists and xenophobes. These we don't even need to talk about. This we condemn. But even people of goodwill find that they simply don't have the material means of helping the refugees. And, of course, what we're saying is that people should not be forced to become refugees. They should not be forced into the role of displaced persons. They should be able to stay in their homes undisturbed by ISIS or Al-Qaeda or any of the other terrorist groups that are there, and then by the fighting that of course does go on. So that is why we've got to find a way to stop the Syrian civil war. The principal way we can do this is by destroying, in effect, ISIS, Al-Qaeda, Nusra, and the other groups, and therefore pacifying this area, allowing a lot of these refugees to stay where they are or return, right? If they're on the way, they can turn around, and if they're already in some destination, a lot of them have expressed the idea that they would like to return home. We've also got this problem going on, right? The governments, right, inside the European Union, governments clash with governments, right? Hungary clashing with its neighbors. In Germany, we have Seehofer, a desperate demagogue, right? The leader of the CSU, Christian Social Union of Bavaria, the old Franz Josef Strauss party. So Seehofer is the current guy. He's actually contending to become the head of the party or be reelected because he is head of the party. He's the prime minister of the federal state of Bavaria. He he's got an election coming up, so he's obviously burnishing his demagogic, xenophobic credentials by giving Merkel a hard time. Merkel has committed very serious mistakes on her own. The idea of encouraging people to come to Germany, I think, is not wise. And then we have this other guy, Gabriel, the deputy chancellor of the Social Democrats. That's the Berlin Grand Coalition. So they're all fighting, right? This government could break up. And actually, it's not like we're so concerned about Merkel, but the problem is the menace of ungovernability, of Weimarization, is very much there. So looking at all this, right, we've got to go beyond complaining. We've got to go beyond griping and whining. And we've got to say what should be done. And I was able in the event there in Friedberg, since I had some slides, I called attention to this critical border area, right? The area along the Turkish-Syrian border where a relatively modest pressure, right, on a world scale, right, a relatively limited effort would be effective in cutting off the ISIS supply lines. And I've got other things on the website talking about it. So let's try to give a brief summary. We're talking about the Turkish-Syrian border. And in particular, what you see is that the Kurds, that is to say the Kurds of the YPG Kurds, the Syrian Kurds, I guess we can say, and including their gallant women fighters, we've got them basically taking control of the Syrian territory south of that border. And that proceeded through battles like Kobane, right? We've seen the Kobane fight going on with the Turks, obviously doing everything possible to help ISIS, but nevertheless, the Kurds carrying the day with U.S. air support. So this is one good thing that the U.S. military was able to do. When you remember when that Kobane siege started, a lot of these media hounds were saying, well, it's really not important. It's really a peripheral thing. No, it's absolutely critical because the way you end this, the military solution that would precede a political solution is that the Kurds take over the entire length of the Turkish-Syrian border. And of course, Erdogan, the madman of Turkey, and his sidekick Davutoglu have said that they will never tolerate the extension of the Kurdish control further than where it is. Now, what we're talking about is this. Get your maps, geographic apparatus ready to go. We're talking about the city of Jarablus. Now, it looks like Jarablus is on the Euphrates River. We're talking the Fertile Crescent, right? Euphrates and Tigris, ET. So on the west end, it's the Euphrates. And then on the western bank of the Euphrates, if the map is serving me well, you've got this town of Jarablus. Now, Jarablus right now is occupied by ISIS. There was an attempt about 10 days ago by the YPG Kurds to cross the Euphrates and take over Jarablus. And this was beaten back, partly with the help of the Turks. Turkish artillery intervened to shell the Kurds. We'll continue the story in just a minute on World Crisis Radio. Welcome back. World Crisis Radio, Webster Tarpley here, back in Washington, D.C., after 2 weeks in Western Europe, in Rome, in the Frankfurt area, actually in Leipzig, all the way over to the Leibniz city of Leipzig. And some time spent at Istanbul Airport. I understand that the flights have now been interrupted in the nighttime because of the war situation in the area, right? The Russian Airbus that was somehow shot down, destroyed, bombed, or underwent some mechanical failure in the past couple of days. So the focus of the world public opinion must be directed to this stretch of land, which goes from Jarablus on the Euphrates in the east and then proceeds west along the Turkish-Syrian border until it reaches the area of a town called Afrin. Afrin. Think of the, I guess it's an aspirin substitute. Afrin or Afran, right? The transliteration of Arabic, always a problem. But from Jarablus to Afrin or Afran, that's the area that we have to look at. That is the area that has to be blocked, cut off, interdicted, made impracticable. Cut the ISIS supply lines through there, and there are also Al-Qaeda, Nusra, and related group supply lines. And you have essentially crippled ISIS. And I would say you do that within a month, ISIS can be destroyed. Now, I pointed to this on Sunday afternoon. It was the afternoon of Sunday, November 1st. And then on the following morning, I happened to get a copy of the Financial Times going through one of these airports. And gosh, here we have an article by Erica Solomon and Jeff Dyer. Syria's Kurds use Russian presence to strengthen their hand. But in particular, we get this American think tanker. I think his name is Aaron Stein. And he says, the fear now, well, it's not the fear, it's the hope now that talks with Russia have encouraged the Kurds to push west towards the largely Kurdish border town of Jarablus, which is in the hands of ISIS. Turkey considers Jarablus a red line. If it is captured, the Kurds could link nearly all pockets of Kurdish territory and could take stronger military action. It could fracture the coalition, says this think tanker. Kurdish commanders say they have no plans to push on Jarablus, although many political leaders, I guess I'm one of them, many political leaders say it is critical to cutting the ISIS supply routes. And you have a nice little map here of the entire situation, courtesy of the Institute for the Study of War, that is to say the Kagan clan. And now there's more. Today on the Diane Rehm Show, National Public Radio, the International Hour from 11 to noon Eastern, Nadia Bilbasi, correspondent, I guess she's the bureau chief for Al Arabiya, the Saudis, here in Washington, D.C. And old Nadia says, look, there is this small strip of land, and this whole stretch of land could be occupied, and it could essentially have very big strategic results, right, impact. So she's talking about the Jarablus to Afrin or Afrin area, and she's pointing in a very vague and somewhat chaotic way to the fact that this is here. And we've got other articles coming forward now on the question of closing this door, closing the last stretch, the Jarablus-Afrin or Afrin corridor. According to one of these think tankers, Turkey has made one thing very clear. It will not tolerate a YPG Kurdish presence west of the Euphrates and will not, therefore, accept a Kurdish-led offensive on the ISIS-held city of Jarablus or any YPG-led effort to unite its territory with the Kurdish-controlled enclave in Afrin in northwestern Syria. So the point is, there is this glob of territory close to the Mediterranean, which is controlled by the Kurds already, and then you've got that long strip that reaches over practically to Jarablus, and it's that 100-mile 100 kilometer stretch in the middle, which is the cynosure of world attention. So, what should happen? Well, it's obvious that the United States, of all people, have developed a kind of cooperation with the Kurds which might make this operation possible. The United States can provide the air cover, and the Kurds can provide the ground troops. Now, it's obvious. They've got to be armed. They've got to be given the sinews of war, modern weapons. These gallant Kurdish fighters and gallant women fighters have got this capability. We're also reading, in October, the United States deployed 12 A-10s at Incirlik in Turkey and dropped 50 tons of ammunition to the YPG-led Syrian Democratic Forces. So in other words, not everything the U.S. does here is bad. And in particular, the U.S. military has announced that it will deploy up to 50 special operations forces to PYD. Now, PYD, YPG, same thing. The PYD is the political arm, and the YPG is the military arm. To YPD-controlled territory, presumably to aid with the future Raqqa offensive. Okay, so you get it. There's a certain concentration of things going on. We have got to demand on social media, in every possible way, put pressure on Obama. Order the U.S. military, crisp orders to the Pentagon, saying, boys, you are going to interdict the Jarablus to Afrin corridor. This is the big issue. We've got to develop a drumbeat of indignation that this has not been done. Now, the obvious way to do it is U.S. and Kurds, because those are the ones who have done it, for example, in Kobane, right? There's an established pattern of cooperation between the U.S. on the one side and the Kurds on the other. And, of course, even Obama now sees that this stuff about the moderate terrorists, this was ridiculous. Get the Kurds. The Kurds are effective. The Kurds are not fanatics. They have these women fighters. They're diverse. They have everything you need, right? You can make yourself into a hero. Now, of course, that's not the only way. I want to call on President Putin of Russia. My call to President Putin is, if the U.S. doesn't immediately close that gap, then Russia should do it, with the Kurds, without the Kurds, any way at all. We'll get to this in a second. Back on World Crisis Radio. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Webster Tarpley here in Washington, D.C. So you see the idea. There is this limited territory, 60 miles across. It can be blocked. It can be done from the air to a large extent. It's going to be much more efficient if you have modest ground forces. Now, you do have this problem of Erdogan, the madman of Istanbul. Erdogan has just had an election. The principal fact about this election is vote fraud, unfair election practices, massive ballot box stuffing, and all the rest. There was, for example, a press conference given by one of the observer teams from the European Union. The chairman of this was, I believe, Swiss, and his conclusion was, this was not a fair election. You had the police going after the opposition. You had that huge bomb blowing up a bunch of pro-Kurdish leftist activists and so forth. Here, Daniel Pipes, the neocon, Daniel Pipes, writing in the National Review, right, reactionary Buckleyite, Daniel Pipes says he's stunned by the fact that Erdogan was actually able to get almost 50% of the vote. And although that's not enough, you need 60% to change the Constitution. He's going to pick up 60% with the help of these block parties, these lesser formations that he can maneuver. So they're going to have a dictatorship. In other words, they put it very delicately on NPR that you're going to have a presidential republic with a very strong presidency. And of course, they say, like the U.S. No, it's not like the U.S. because in the U.S. we have checks and balances, right? We have a whole complicated system, which has actually served us well up until maybe recently. But in the case of Turkey, it's going to be a presidential republic with no checks and balances. It's going to be the uncontrollable, running wild dictatorship of Recep Tayyip Erdogan. So not fair. Vote fraud. It's going to be a one-party state. As I said, Russia. We can understand perfectly, and we sympathize and support what Russia has done up to now. It is essential, of course, to stabilize the Assad government, to stabilize the region around Latakia. The Russians have to defend their air base there. But that is now, you know, a month and a week that this has been going on. We say it is time, we could even say it's high time, that Russia, with its very effective air force, which has excited the admiration of the world, Russia must turn its attention to the Jarablus to Afrin corridor and start bombing and start preventing the money from coming in, the ammunition from coming in, the fuel from coming in, the fanatical recruits from coming in, and by the same token, prevent the stolen oil which is being shipped out by the son of Erdogan, who is the principal oil smuggler on the scene, and of course the wounded terrorists who are then taken up into a hospital by the daughter of Erdogan. So, if the U.S. and the Kurds can do it, that's great. Again, if the lunatic war party here is still too strong, the neocons and so forth, then Russia and the Kurds, one would hope, could do it. And as I pointed out in Germany, there has been German rearmament, you know, in the 1950s. It happened. There's now a Bundeswehr. There's now a German army, of all things. There's also a German navy. And it would not be too hard for Germany to simply say, we have a paramount national interest here at stake, and we want to send in those forces, right? The Bundeswehr is going to stretch itself along that 100-kilometer corridor and make sure that nothing gets in or out. The small strip, as Nadia Bilbasi of El Arabiya put it, right? Or this other group writing in the Financial Times, right? But of course, you heard it first here, right? 12 hours ahead, 14 hours ahead of the Financial Times, you heard it from me. But now the point is, stir the pot. Get the buzz going. Let's talk about it. Now, there's also this complicating factor. A Russian civilian airliner, Airbus, with 225 people on board has been destroyed. And there is now this tug of war between those who say this was a bomb and those who say this was an unexplicable event so far. I would simply say this. I think it's likely to me that it's a bomb, but it's likely that this is some kind of an operation by terrorists, ultimately depending on the NATO bureaucracy, to come in there and give Russia a hard time. So that has now led, I think, wisely, President Putin has stopped all Russian flights to Egypt. That should not go on too long, but there must be a way to essentially clarify this issue. The United States, above all, must arm and support the YPG, and they must administer to Erdogan a decisive rebuff. Erdogan, back off. United States' paramount national interest requires that part of the border be shut down, interdicted. And since you won't do it, you won't do it with your Turkish forces on the northern side of that border, it's going to have to be done on the south side of the border. So that is our situation. Get that map. Take a look at Jarablus on the Euphrates. And again, the Kurds tried to take it in the last 10 days. Now, there's also a history involved in this, which I highlighted in one of our briefings. I guess it's the Friday briefing. The Saturday briefing. And this has to do with the fact that this total control by the Kurds of the entire Turkish-Syrian border all the way to Jarablus, that was accomplished essentially with a kind of a spring-summer offensive by the Kurds, April, May, June, July, which was focused on the town of, let's see here, it's a town along the way, it turned out to be the key to this entire thing. Tel Abyad, T-E-L-A-B-Y-A-D. Now, that was the big battle of this past summer. And when the Kurds won that battle, we are told that it was absolute hysteria among the Erdogan people in Ankara. They went nuts, began issuing ultimatums. For example, I think we have some choice quotes from the Turkish press at the time. They were saying, Kurdish state in the making in northern Syria with U.S. assistance. I wish. Kurdish ethnic cleansing of Arabs and Turkmens. Ridiculous. Corridor opening to move northern Iraq oil to the Mediterranean. Look, they let that out of the bag. This is from the AL Monitor, June 22nd, 2015. Corridor opening to move northern Iraq oil to the Mediterranean. So that's Erdogan's son doing that. So he's getting hype in the Turkish press. And, of course, the Turkish theme is the Democratic Union Party, right, YPG or these other initials that we have, more dangerous than ISIS. Absolutely ridiculous. So that is what gave the Kurds the control all the way to Jarablus. And that's exactly when John Allen went into action with Erdogan saying, wait a minute, we're going to stop the Kurds from getting in there. We're going to make that into a safe zone for terrorists with a NATO air cover over it. So that game has to end. Back to the minute on World Crisis Radio. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. So the entire world needs to focus and to some extent is focusing on this critical stretch, right? This narrow corridor, this couloir, we might say, that goes from Jarablus on the Euphrates to Afrin, close to the Mediterranean. There is even beyond, on the other side of the Afrin corridor, there's another stretch of Turkish-Syrian border area, but that doesn't lead into anything. That leads into a kind of cul-de-sac. It leads into just an area which is surrounded on all sides by pro-Assad forces. And I think there have been some Russian attacks there. So again, we understand what Russia has done up to now. But at this point, it is time. It is imperative. World public opinion must demand that the United States help the Kurds do it or that Russia help the Kurds do it. And if that doesn't happen, I think that's going to be a tragedy. And it will lead to many questions being asked. And then again, if none of that works, Germany would have to say, we don't want to be inundated by this tragic situation, the wave of displaced persons and refugees and so forth. We've got to do the humanitarian thing, which is to allow these people to stay in their homes, not to face the rigors of this Calvary-like trip of hundreds and hundreds of miles. We're going to go in there and seal that border area, and we're going to make sure that ISIS withers on the vine within a matter of weeks, a month, I would say, at the very most. Now, just a couple of things about what sort of an area is this, right? The YPG, the Good Kurds, because good Kurds, there are the Barzani Kurds in northern Iraq. They're not so good Kurds. Then there's the PKK. That's sort of the middle rank of the Kurds. But the good Kurds are the YPG. They entered Tel Abyad with the support of the U.S. Air Force and of Arab fighters such as Burkan al-Firat. They control a contiguous 180-kilometer or 110-mile stretch from Ras al-Ain to Jarablus. So the border of South Kurdistan to the Euphrates at Jarablus, the YPG controls 400 kilometers, 250 miles of border. The next potential target, the target that we're talking about right now, is the line from Jarablus to Afrin, 110 kilometers, or 68 miles by their count. Maybe I'm doing as the crow flies and they're doing through the various winding roads. The area between Afrin and Jarablus Jazeera is home to several different ethnic groups. In the Jazeera canton, this is part of the corridor, there are Kurds, Arabs, Syriacs, Chaldeans, Armenians, and Chechens. Arabs make up 30% of the population. The Kobani and Afrin cantons are predominantly Kurdish. At Tel Abyad, the Kurds constitute 40 to 45% of the population. In Jarablus, Arabs and Turkmens are in the majority. There is no doubt that many Kurds dream of a fully fledged, united West Kurdistan from Jazeera to Afrin. And that's the other thing. Obama, seize the initiative. Push aside Skull and Bones, Kerry, Nuland, these other creatures, Samantha Power, the humanitarian bomber. What we're going to need is the United States sponsorship of an independent Kurdish state. In other words, get the leaders of the YPG and their political arm to Washington and proclaim in a White House ceremony independent Kurdistan. Now, that would at this point be West Kurdistan. Let that become the Piedmont, right? The Piedmont of a new independent country. Piedmont meaning, of course, that, you know, as Piedmont, you know, the Kingdom of Sardinia in Italy from the 1840s to the 1870s became the center around which United Italy was constructed. So we need a Piedmont. So let's start with West Kurdistan, proclaim that at the White House, win the Kurds as eternal allies for the United States by making that gesture, right? And it would be highly substantive. If the United States won't do it, well, then maybe Russia should do it, right? Or if the German forces can go in there, then they could sponsor an independent Kurdish state. Whoever does it is going to make some permanent friends. They'll make some temporary enemies among the Erdogan group, but the Erdogan group has to go no matter what else happens. So this character Sanger of the New York Times said, well, if it turns out that that really was an ISIS bomb, really done by ISIS, that might prod Russia to give a greater priority to bombing ISIS. Because the thing is, as we've said, Russia has bombed primarily these other groups, right? The Free Syrian Army, the Nusra Brigades, Al-Qaeda, and so forth. And again, we're not criticizing that. We're simply saying, right now, if you want to be a friend of Europe, you've got to take care of ISIS. And it's not even such a big operation, right? It's simply the interdiction of a border. So I urge everybody to get involved with that. So let's now change gears. We want to talk about U.S. Domestic politics. Some of this stuff is funny. Now, this we can use this as comic relief. Ben Carson is cratering. I think today being Friday the 6th of November, Ben Carson has essentially blown his cover as a serious candidate. In other words, he's highly unstable, mentally an unreliable person. Ben Carson has written an autobiography, a campaign autobiography, where he says that he got into a fight with his friend Bob, and he tried to kill his friend Bob with a knife, I think. Now, the pattern that we're seeing in all these cases is that Carson says, yes, I did these things, and the media says, prove it. But unfortunately, from the point of view of the voter, the fact that Carson is claiming to have done these things this makes him look more and more like a, well, a mentally unstable person who should not be involved in the Oval Office. Carson insists that he tried to hit his mother with a hammer. He says that he threw a rock at somebody's face and broke their glasses. He has gotten into a feud with CNN. He was on there today. Carson says to CNN, you know, do you think I'm a pathological liar? I was reminded of Richard Nixon saying, I am not a crook. Carson then says that the pyramids of Egypt were actually not mausoleums, not tombs, but were built for grain storage. Carson says that Obamacare is the modern equivalent of slavery. He also says that if the Jewish population of Germany had been suitably armed, they could have stopped Hitler. He's also got ideas about having a third class of bathrooms, men, women, and transgender. And Carson says that the coverage on his campaign offered by the networks is all garbage. What can we make of this? It seems to me that this candidacy was extremely fragile, and now these reckless, irresponsible, and unverifiable statements, I think, will tend to rule him out of consideration. Now, we got other problems going on for these people. We've got Bernie Sanders. We'll get to him in just a second on World Crisis Radio. Welcome to the second hour of World Crisis Radio. It's the 6th of November, 2015, and this is Webster Tarpley once again. Now, we have a very important report coming up. This is from Pino Cabras, who is currently located on that wonderful island of Sardinia in the Mediterranean, which is his base of operations. So Pino Cabras was...
Hello. Hello, how are you?
Ciao. Pino Cabras was the organizer, or one of the principal organizers, of this conference that we had in Rome. On the 26th of October in the Sala Cavour, we had this large and significant international conference on no to NATO and no to war. So I thought it would be good to get Pino on to give you a summary of what went on, some of the high points, but also the idea that this conference is setting up a mechanism, a kind of clearinghouse for information about people who want to fight against NATO excesses and the maneuvers, right, the Trident juncture and so forth. So, Pino, please give the listeners an idea of what went on.
Yes, Europe is punctuated of many peace movements that in the last decades have lost the capacity of doing a network and connecting themselves. And now our first goal was to collect a large number of signatures under our call for a neutral Europe. And we have been able to create an European committee where they will converge all those movements, political parties, trade unions, cultural organizations, single individuals, journalists who share this goal. At the moment, we have collected 10 countries' movements. That is a good starting point.
Okay. And so that's going to go on. If we could just maybe just backtrack a little bit, right? I would say a couple of the high points of the conference were the first, obviously the speech by the famous investigating judge Ferdinando Imposimato, who was there and spoke.
The honorary president of the Supreme Court of Italy.
Right. And I translated it, so it's hard to remember, but principally the idea was his investigation of the Moro assassination pointed to the CIA. And at the same time, his investigation of 9/11 pointed to the fact that this was actually a staged provocation and not at all what the U.S. Government or the Kane-Hamilton Commission has said. Then we also had senator from Latvia talking.
Yes,
about
she's an European member of the parliament, of the European Parliament, Tatiana Zdanoka.
Zdanoka, right.
Yes, we also have members of the parliament from Cyprus, from Norway, and from Italy as well. Many important members of the parliament from Italy.
Now, on that, the interesting thing was that the Italian presence was, of course, extremely important. It was, what, a half a dozen senators, some of them from the five-star movement of Beppe Grillo,
yeah,
but some also from other parties. And maybe you talk a little bit about the politics of that.
Yes, in Italy, there is raising a strong opposition now against the new military posture of Italy. In the recent days, in the very last week, we had some important release in Sardinia, in Sicily, in Naples, where we have seen an interesting movement against the war. That is the main goal of this struggle against the NATO maneuvers.
The other thing that struck me was people from Sicily, you also, right, pointing out that, you know, Italy, this wonderful garden of the world, is now being, you know, soiled and polluted by, you know, military maneuvers, like shooting off, you know, hundreds of thousands of rounds of ammunition. These bases are, you know, dirty and, you know, they are a public nuisance, and people want to get rid of them just on the basis of not even what they would do in war, but what they mean in peacetime or a quasi-peacetime.
Yeah, this is something very strange to see thousands of soldiers in this big war game that is like having an army in a war, even if we are supposed to be in peace in this moment. And many speeches during the meeting have explained very well that getting out of NATO, even if it would trigger many political problems for Italy, would cause a net gain in the environment in terms of political profit and reducing the danger of being involved in some war we didn't decide to be in. So we are trying to create the knowledge of the dividend, the gain we can achieve with neutral posture of Italy. Neutral means that nobody will perceive a country as an enemy. It means to achieve more national security and have a chance in peace process in North Africa and Middle East.
Right, and not be a protectorate of anybody. I guess concerning this maneuver, Trident Juncture, I guess this is over by now. Am I right?
No, it's not over. It's
still going on. Why don't you give us an update on that?
Yeah, they are continuing to shoot an incredible quantity of ammunition, and they are involving 28 countries concentrated in some Mediterranean areas. And this is huge, and it is perceived like the largest war game in the latest 25 years. So this is a strange creature for a peace movement, for a peace alliance, supposed to be.
Exactly. Well, this is exactly what it's not. So now, what's next on your agenda? When's the next meeting? What are the organizational steps, and maybe how people from over here could relate to them?
I think we have to share the goal of networking many organizations to create a European peace movement. At the moment, many people in Europe doesn't even know what NATO is about, how influential is in the life of many countries. So our aim now is to build a new connection, even at the media level, institute an international news and information network. This is a good starting point for the next 3 months.
And I guess you have Pandora Television, which is already active, right?
Yes. Now we are broadcasting in the web, and we are trying to create a stronger TV network and to be able to go by satellite and to broadcast in three different languages.
And I would also point out one memorable speech for me was Giulietto Chiesa, who was, in some ways, the chairman of the entire event, right? And Giulietto is a heroic figure, right? He was the Moscow correspondent for the L'Unità of the Italian Communist Party, then of La Stampa, of Fiat, but also a member of the European Parliament. He's the one who did really yeoman service on 9/11 Truth. He was the only one in the European Parliament who did this with any thoroughness. And one of the things Giulietto Chiesa pointed out that has stuck in my mind is that people simply don't know what NATO is. They've never heard of it. So the younger generation, even before you get to what to do, you got to somehow make this point that there's this oppressive international octopus which interferes in countries.
Yeah. His first aim is information. This is a clue for doing movements and organizations.
Okay. Pino, thank you for being with us. We'll have you back soon again to talk about precisely more information as you develop it, okay?
Thank you.
Thanks very much. Pino Capras in Sardinia. Lucky him. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. This is Webster Tarpley here in Washington, D.C. Now, we went through the cratering of Ben Carson. We'll get back to him in a minute because he does have policies, and man, they are insane. But now we have Bernie Sanders, our wonderful mushhead hero, who not doing so well, right? Bernie did yeoman service when he ran interference for Hillary, right? He was that blocking back who prevented Hillary from getting gang-tackled in the Democratic debate. They were all ready to go to town on the emails and her dishonesty, her surreptitious nature, all this stuff. But Bernie stepped in and said, I don't want to hear about your damn emails. And that, of course, saved the day for Hillary. So as a result of that, there are some who would think that the Democratic nomination is practically wrapped up. Reality, however, always richer than these simple formulations. So what we now see is that Bernie, after having pontificated for months and years now that he would not do negative campaigning, oh my God, because we know that the fussy independents and the petty bourgeois good government types don't like polemics of any kind, right? All kinds of, there are even age groups that don't like polemics, like some of the younger ones. Bernie had pledged that he wouldn't go negative, but now Bernie is going negative. Bernie is talking about Hillary Clinton's emails. He's going negative. Now, the thing is that he doesn't go negative, really. He only does it as a kind of a half-hearted thing to kind of keep people on board. Reminds me a little bit of Bill Bradley back in 2000, right? Wouldn't fight. Bernie, of course, will not fight. So, but what he does do is to say, I'm covering the issue, right? This is CYA for Bernie. He says, I'm talking about our emails. Now, it's not in his television ads, his radio ads. He doesn't have all that. He doesn't go through the mantra of all the things that Hillary has done. Doesn't do any of that. So we regard this as yet another piece of nonsense. Now, one of the things Pino Capras was telling me in the break was that in Cagliari, it's written C-A-G-L-I-A-R-I, Cagliari, Sardinia, the capital of Sardinia, there was a shipment of ordnance, right, of bombs that were sent by NATO to Saudi Arabia to start bombing Yemen. And as in this case, as in all others, we say to Bernie Sanders, where's the condemnation? Where's the indignation? Where's your pledge that you won't do it? Where's your attempt to shut this down? We also had one of the Saudi political prisoners this past week received the Sakharov Prize of the European Parliament. That means this guy is really important on the international stage. Bernie, those are your friends, right? The guy who made the award was Manfred Schulz, I think his name is, the German Social Democrat, who's the chairman, speaker, in effect, of the European Parliament, right? Bernie, how come you don't do any of that? Why do you still praise Saudi Arabia? So all of that going on. So that's Bernie. We also have this funny tape, I guess, with Sign of the Times. We have a bunch of kids, right, Latino kids who come out and inveigh in, what can we say, obscene language against Donald Trump, a bunch of kids cursing at Trump because of his racism. Well, I guess he's been asking for it. Now, let's talk about Trump and Carson, right, since this is the issue. At least we better talk about Carson while he's still there, because I have a feeling that he's going to be cratering, as we've said. Paul Ryan was sold to the American people by the corrupt, treacherous media as a moderate. Remember a couple of weeks ago? Oh, there's that group, the Freedom Caucus of mean old Tea Party reactionaries, conservatives, as they would say. But then there's the wonderful moderate Paul Ryan. So let's all get behind the wonderful moderate Paul Ryan. Well, as I tried to point out during this process, Paul Ryan is not a moderate. Paul Ryan is a reactionary, now with more and more elements of fascism in his activities, right? And this is the biggest crime of the U.S. media, at least on the domestic front, is not alerting people to the fact that the Republican Party has now got two factions, reactionaries and fascists. Forget about, you know, moderates and extreme conservatives. No. Reactionaries and fascists. So, last week, Ryan kicked off his speakership by passing a highway bill. Now, highway bills are supposed to go on for 6 years, this one goes on for three. Highway bills are supposed to provide $300 billion over 6 years. That's really meager, but I suppose better than nothing. In this case, the Transportation Infrastructure Highway Bill is 3 years and $150 billion, and it has no funding. It has no funding. It's just an authorization bill. It can't be put into action under the existing budget rules. So this is duplicitous. So a cheap trick by Ryan kicks it off. Now, the other thing is the Washington Post highlighted here on, I guess it was Thursday, that we now have the clash in the GOP, says the Washington Post of Thursday, November 5th. A divide over benefits. Medicare splits Ryan and Trump. Yeah. So Ryan, the great John Birch Society fanatic from, you know, deeply reactionary Wisconsin, says we're going to have to attack the entitlements. We're going to attack Social Security. We're going to attack Medicare and Medicaid. So he wants to gouge entitlements. Now, I must say, this is genocide against the American people. If you do this, right, we have an exhausted and depleted population. If you try gouging them more, the morbidity and mortality results will become quickly apparent. So this is the reality. Now, on the other side, though, we have Trump. Here, let's see what Trump says. Trump gets into a fight with Ben Carson. So Carson says, you know, we got to get rid of it. The quote from Trump is, Ben wants to get rid of Medicare. You can't get rid of Medicare. It would be a horrible thing to get rid of. It actually works. You get rid of the fraud, waste, and abuse, it works. Ben wants to get rid of Medicare. You can't do it. We'll be back in a minute on World Crisis Radio. This is a dog and pony show, in case you haven't guessed. Back in a minute. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Webster Tarpley here in Washington, D.C. Now, Carson, as we said, is the guy who wants to attack your lifeline. In other words, your health care and your pension. He wants to gouge those. Now, when the Republicans have to talk about health care, they fall back on a series of cheap threadbare subterfuges, right? Cheap tricks that have been around for decades. Some of these go back to, in the case of Medicare, they go back to the 1960s. In other words, the Republican, you know, the Goldwater Republican answer to Medicare, or into the 1970s. What they all talk about is this, again, this shop-worn piece of nonsense, the health savings account. So the health savings account, a high deductible insurance plan where you put in, you know, as much money as you can. But the problem that it is that the risk is all on you. And if the money runs out, this pittance, this wretched pittance that you've been able to put into the health savings account, then you are out of luck. You will be foreclosed on. You will go into bankruptcy. You will be finished in all of these ways. Now they say, oh, you're incentivized to stay well. You're incentivized not to go for needless tests. And of course, what they want to do is gouge you because they don't have the guts to tax Wall Street, right? The answer to all of these things in terms of the federal budget, and they're going to be talking about this, the 1% Wall Street sales tax. 1% on every trade, every act of buying and selling, derivatives above all, stocks, bonds, probably not federal bonds, but corporate bonds, to be sure, maybe not state bonds, but everything else, every other kind of transaction, right? Those all EDFs, whatever it is. So that's the answer to it. So, because these people, as servants and stooges of Wall Street, they want to say, let's have the wonders of a health savings account. Now, the young person might say, yeah, I'm invincible. I'm going to live forever. The person who's blinded by greed might say, yeah, I'm going to hoard that money and then I'll get to spend it at the end of the day. The idea then is you're not going to get preventive care. Right, the deductibles are high. You can't deal with the out of pocket if you're going to get, you know, preventive care, the kind of, you know, timely stuff. And there's also a track record of health savings accounts, right? Under health savings accounts, individuals are more likely to avoid, skip, or delay health care because of the cost. HSA, health savings accounts, as experiments have failed in other countries. They caused financial hardship in Singapore. They undermined the cost effectiveness of healthcare system there. In South Africa, the 10 years of health savings accounts show that this sort of this consumer driven, it's actually driven by necessity. The cost of specialty care has increased by 43%. The cost of hospital care is up by 65%. Uninsured rates have gone up dramatically, right? Now, the other side of it is the people who are going to make money off this. It's like privatizing Social Security. If you privatize Social Security, then the people who make out like bandits are the bandits. That is to say, Wall Street, the stockbrokers, because they're going to get the commissions on all these trades. But don't look now. It's not just on the Social Security side. If you start tampering with Medicare, right, putting in these vouchers and the rest of this stuff, you will enrich the financial services industry, says the New York Times. Banks, credit unions, and money management firms are now quietly positioning themselves to become central players in the business of healthcare by offering health savings accounts, tapping into the $75 billion of new money that will be at stake if a lunatic like Ben Carson gets in. So now the other side of it is, if Trump says that he will not tamper with Medicare, what is a Trump promise worth? And I say nothing. For example, you can't believe the Donald. He's been a Democrat. He's been a Republican. He's been an independent. He has bought and sold politicians of all stripes and colors. He has been pro-abortion, anti-abortion. He's been against the war on drugs, and he's been for the war on drugs. He wanted, at one point, he said, let's have an asset tax on not just income, but assets, 14.25% to pay off the national debt. Later, he wanted Bush tax cuts, right? Tax cuts for the rich. So he's for gun control, against gun control, for universal health care, then against it. Now it's mainly the repeal of Obamacare and a system based on competition. He wanted the privatization of Social Security. Now he's against it. He wanted Hillary Clinton and Jeb Bush to be great, and now he's against both of them. So this is ridiculous. Now also, let's also remember presidents in general, the historical side. When Richard Nixon ran for president in 1968, he claimed to have a plan, secret plan in his pocket to end the Vietnam War. There was no plan, and the war went on for five more years. Too bad if you died. Jimmy Carter ran in 1976 saying, I'll never lie to you. Well, he lied out of all corners of his mouth. Reagan said, I will never negotiate with terrorists. I will never trade arms for hostages. But Iran-Contra, George H.W. Bush, Oliver North, and all that ran the White House. Bush the Elder also said, read my lips, no new taxes. But then, of course, he raised taxes. Clinton, the friend of the masses, wiped out welfare as we had known it. He repealed Glass-Steagall and deregulated toxic derivatives. Obama, in 2008, ran as a protectionist. He said that he didn't like NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Area, and that he was going to renegotiate that. And, of course, at the same time, he sent his advisor, Austin the Ghoul Goolsby of Skull and Bones, to a Canadian consulate to say, by the way, guys, this is just election year demagogy and rhetoric, and don't you worry about it, right? Now, we want to also pay attention to some of these other guys, like Ted Cruz. What does he have? They all have health savings accounts. This is basically it. Cruz comes down to three things. Abolish states' rights. In other words, don't let states regulate insurance companies. Have the race to the bottom. So you can, an insurance company can operate across state lines without regard to state regulation. This is a strange position for these neo-Confederate states' rights freaks. Number two, expand self-health savings accounts. And number three, de-link health insurance from employment. Now, what is the point of that? This was in the Franklin D. Roosevelt World War II economy. You couldn't offer more money because of wage and price controls, but you could offer these perks. And that's essentially how it came about. Christie has a 12-point plan to loot and gouge Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, disability, Social Security, disability, which is so many people have run out of unemployment benefits, they have tended to fall back on their Social Security disability, and that is now being depleted. Once again, what's the answer? The 1% Wall Street sales tax. So these are the Republicans. We'll do the Democrats, too. Make no mistake, we'll get the Democrats, too. But in this case, it's just so blatant and so obscene and horrendous. And we'll be back in a minute on World Crisis Radio. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio, our last segment already. Let's try to cover as much as we can. Now, the first thing is, the world is being subjected to a coordinated, massive brainwashing campaign. The idea is to force us all into a block universe in terms of our mental life. It is a Malthusian, zero growth, anti-human, limits to growth approach. And it's coming out of all pores, I guess, of world public opinion. First of all, let's note, unfortunately, this terrible mistake, this really lamentable posture of the Vatican on the question of so-called anthropogenic global warming. Now, last week, on the, I guess, the 27th or 28th of October, we had the Catholic bishops of the world come out with a statement where they point with hysteria, I guess, at the situation of the world environment, this alleged global warming, supposedly anthropogenic, and they talk about abandoning, in the short run, coal and oil. I'm sorry, this will lead, in the nicest terms that I can say it, to a radical increase in morbidity and mortality across the globe. It would be a hecatomb if we turned away abruptly from so-called fossil fuels, right? So-called oil and coal. This cannot be done, must not be done. And this is simply stepping way beyond the purview of a religious organization and a church. Now, of course, there's more. The World Health Organization has come out with a blood-curdling report saying, no more salami for you, no cold cuts, no hot dogs, and no red meat. Again, I think it was Il Giornale, reactionary, but fine. Gold is where you find it in this ideological chaos that we're living in. The Il Giornale said this was a terrorist report from the incompetent World Health Organization. And I guess on that one, they're on firm ground. And now we're going to have this Paris conference. This will be a grand guignol of Malthusian excess. Absolutely crazy. And, it's coming. And now today, Obama gets into the act. No to the Keystone Pipeline. Oh, my God. Not that the world has to revolve around the Keystone Pipeline, but a country that has, I believe at this point, 750,000 miles of oil and gas pipelines going back to the big inch of World War II because of all those German submarines were sinking the tankers off the East Coast thoroughly. Had to fall back on the big inch, and then it has started from there. Many would say that the Keystone itself is it's a symbolic issue. In other words, the stuff is already being produced. It's already being shipped. This might be a better way to ship it than some others, but maybe, in other words, it's not like this is so important by itself, but it also shows the ideological bankruptcy of Obama and Kerry, right? Because it's allegedly the State Department who did this. So the answer is no, it will not be built. The company, again, TransCanada, wants to come back under a new president. They're appealing to a better informed president at some future time. Brace yourselves now for an orgy of pessimistic propaganda. Brace yourself. It's going to be horrendous. It's going to be, again, a grand guignol. And one of the reasons for it, as we have pointed out, is that the so-called warming seems to have slowed. In other words, the warming is either slow or it's non-existent. And fairly honest experts in the field have pointed to the fact that if we don't get some warming fairly soon, the entire theoretical edifice of climate science will collapse. And again, climate science is for charlatans. It's like saying, I'm a PhD in history, but I only do anti-French history or anti-Russian or anti-Brazilian history. That's not how you do it. The conclusions cannot be built in to the degree. But in this case, if you're a climate scientist, it's clear you have one big axe to grind, right? And that's the anthropogenic side. And of course that you've got to have, you got to get back to solar cells and windmills. Solar cells will never produce the energy that went into making them. Neither will most windmills. So you have an economy based on renewable energy, which represents a net loss of energy, a net minus of energy. This cannot work. So even the new Prime Minister of Canada, right, who seems to be Malthusian to a very large degree, right, Trudeau, thinking the Canadian economy said that he wanted this built. So it hasn't happened. Okay, so brace yourself for this. Now, yesterday was November 5th, so it was Guy Fawkes. And once again, we have to congratulate Oxford Circus, I guess it is. We have to congratulate MI5 and MI6 in particular for their ability to impose this particular piece of nonsense on the world, in particular with this crazy movie from 2007, V for Vendetta. They have set the tone culturally and in terms of costumes for a whole generation of people who are sort of on the margins of things. Just remember that it's not true. In other words, Guy Fawkes was a patsy. Guy Fawkes did not know what he was doing. And the leaders of this conspiracy, right, the people who tried, first they tried to tunnel in to the basement of the Houses of Parliament from another house, from another basement. That was too complicated a task. So then we have the people like Guy Fawkes getting into the Houses of Parliament and bringing these barrels, allegedly, of gunpowder, right? So they were going to blow up King James the First. And this was, of course, a key provocation in setting up or continuing the police state that had been begun under Elizabeth II and her pursuivants, that is to say, her spooks, right, her internal security spooks. And it did. It caused a hysteria. If you want to know, you know, how Shakespeare saw it, you can basically look at Macbeth, because Macbeth is the immediate play by Shakespeare coming in the wake of the Guy Fawkes event. Now, remember, the people, this was a state plot, right? This was state-sponsored terrorism. And the guy, of course, who did it was Lord Robert Cecil. Cecil. Lord Salisbury. Because this is, the Guy Fawkes occurs in the middle of what is known as the Regnum Cecilianum, which is Robert Cecil's father, Lord Burghley, I believe, who was the advisor to Elizabeth II in the first part of her reign. And then Robert Cecil is the advisor to Elizabeth, but then in particular after the death of Elizabeth, he gets to be the advisor to James the First. So Cecil wants to have anti-Catholic hysteria, and he gets it. And the other thing to mention is that in the background we have Ben Johnson. Ben Johnson in touch with the Venetian embassy. So this is a fraud. This is a false flag event. Don't believe it. And put away those silly masks. Those are creepy. You creep out the public with those masks. See you in a minute. Back in a week on World Crisis Radio.